and then I went through a tunnel steeped in tungsten light and began a slow, meandering ascent. These mountains were so close, only 2 hours and 15 minutes from our home, but I saw them rarely nowadays. The trees dropped away from the roadside, and I passed a sign, "Welcome to Y. We're glad you're here." The town was run down and gray, like so many of the old coal and steel towns that dotted the state. I'd describe the houses that line the main thoroughfare as ramshackle, but ramshackle suggests a charm that these lacked. A traffic light hung above the lone intersection, and except for a cat that darted behind a garbage can, there was no movement. I stopped at a gas station whose prices were a full 80 cents above the state average. I had consulted the price before my departure. I went inside the mini-mart to pay for my gas and picked up a bottle of water.
"It's 2 for 1, said the morose-looking adolescent behind the counter.
There was a tiny television suspended from the ceiling, playing a program I did not recognize.
"What?" I said.
"You can get one bottle more for free," he said.
A constellation of pustules clustered at his jaw, in the elliptical shape of the Andromeda Galaxy. They were tipped in yellowish-green domes. How he resisted lancing them was anyone's guess.
"I don't want one more bottle," I said, pushing my money across the counter.
He looked puzzled, but picked up the bills.
"You heading up the mountain?" he said.
"Yes," I said, relieved that he had asked me. "To the residency, at Devil's Throat." His finger faltered over the register's buttons. His hand crimped as if he were experiencing pain. He rubbed his jaw, and then looked up at me with an unreadable expression. One of his pimples had opened and left a comet's trail of pus across his skin. I was about to ask him if he'd ever been to that part of the mountain, when a trill of music sounded from the television above us. On the screen, a young woman in a nightgown stood barefoot in a stand of trees. She slowly lifted her arms out to the side, groping at the air, then flapping listlessly like a stunned bird that's just struck a window. She opened her mouth, as if to call out for help, but then soundlessly closed and opened it again, like a patient with a secret on her deathbed. The camera cut to behind the trees, where a group of girls watched the unfortunate young woman take one stumbling step, then another. One of them, leaning into her neighbor's ear, whispered, "Not everybody's cut out for this, I guess." Then a laugh track ripped open the audio, and the youth guffawed as he punched numbers into the cash register.
"What is this?" I whispered, disturbed.
"Rerun," he grunted.
The change he returned to me was damp with sweat. Outside, I touched my face and was startled to discover tears, the temperature of blood. Soon my car tipped upward, and I was climbing the mountain again. In my adolescence, I had a standing obligation to attend Girl Scout camp for a long weekend every autumn with the rest of my troop. Since we left after school, and in late October, by the time we arrived in these mountains, we were beset by an inky darkness. In the back seat of Mrs. Z's minivan, the girls fell into silence and sleep, having been so long on the road, and having exhausted conversation well before leaving civilization. After the incident, I always sat in the passenger seat. It was fine, as I preferred the company of adults to that of my peers. In the car, the only light was the luminous glow of the dashboard. Mrs. Z stared straight ahead, and her daughter, an enemy of mine but a fine-looking girl of great height and chestnut-brown hair, would inevitably be asleep in the back seat, her skull rapping on the glass of her window every time the vehicle struck a bump, though it never woke her. Next to her, the other girls would be staring into the middle distance, or also resting their eyes,
Outside, the car's headlights cut through the night, illuminating a constantly rotating film strip of pavement, fallen branches and blowing leaves, and the occasional slurry of red and flesh where a stag had met its end since the last rainfall. Occasionally, Mrs. Z would look over at me, take a breath through her nose, and then murmur something generic. "How is school?" was a favorite. I knew that she was keeping her voice low so as not to wake her daughter, or let her daughter know that she was talking to me, and so I did the same, and said something generic in return.
"Good. I like English class."
There was no way to explain to this particular woman that school was adequate for learning and terrible for everything else, and that her own sweet-mouthed daughter, whom she had birthed, held, fed, and loved for many years, was a distinct percentage of this misery. And then we'd fall silent again, and the forest stretched on and on. On either side of the road, the white trunks of the trees were illuminated to a degree, the kind of brief visibility provided by a camera's flash at midnight. I saw a layer or two of trees, and beyond that an opaque blackness that was disturbing to me. Autumn was the worst time to go into the mountains, I thought to myself. To drive into the wilderness, when it writhed and gasped for air, seemed foolish. I turned off the air conditioner. If only those girls could see me now, an adult, married, magnificent in my accomplishments. The radio was tuned to a classical station, which was playing a grand, jaunty song that moved along irregularly, dipping and swelling as I drove through the curves. It was like the beginning of an old film, a vehicle weaving along roads to reach its destination behind white-lettered credits. As the credits ended, the car would pull up to an old farmhouse, where I would get out, untying a white scarf from my hair and calling the name of my old friend. She'd emerge with a wave, and the laughter and rapport we'd share carrying my suitcases into the house would in no way foreshadow the gruesome plot whose wheels were already turning. "That was Isaac Albeniz," the announcer intoned, "and his Spanish Rhapsody." After a while, the peaks began to chew up the music, eventually reducing it all to static. I flipped the radio off and rolled the window down, resting my elbow on the rubber lip and feeling very satisfied. Then I noticed the car behind me, a low white behemoth that hovered too close. I felt a strange spiral behind my navel, the downward swirl that might precede fear or arousal. Then there was a change, which I perceived before I understood it. Red and blue light spilled into my car. The police officer sat behind me for a full 2 minutes before opening his door and crunching in my direction.
"Good afternoon," he said.
His eyes were small, but oddly kind. He had a reddish patch at the corner of his lip, a fever sore, ready to bloom.
"Good afternoon," I responded.
"Do you know why I pulled you over?"
he asked. "I certainly have no idea," I said.
"You were speeding," he said. "You were going 57 in a 45 zone."
"Ah," I said.
"Where are you heading?"
he asked. As we spoke, the reddish patch seemed to sense me and expand outward, like an amoeba preparing for reproduction. He had a wedding ring, and so, barring any recent tragedies, there was a spouse who had seen this mark as recently as this morning. I imagined her. You may think me presumptuous to assume that his spouse was a woman, given my own particular circumstances, but there was something in his demeanor that suggested to me that he had never touched a man without anger or force or anxiety, and even now he touched the ring unconsciously with his thumb, suggesting affection, maybe even an erotic memory. Being a woman entirely unlike me, that is, she was a woman unafraid of contagion. I imagined her kissing his mouth, perhaps even procuring a tiny tube of cream from a basket of many kinds of creams,
and dabbing it on, saying something soothing to him.
No one will notice, I'm sure,
and squeezing his shoulder. Perhaps they had a single fever sore that they traded back and forth like an infant exchanged between them. When I emerged from my musings, his car had already driven out of sight. I looked at the paper he'd given me, a warning.
Drive slowly, arrive safe. Officer M, it said in sad, blocky handwriting at the top.
I soon reached a T-junction, where the sign indicated I was to turn left to go to Devil's Throat. The other direction would take me back to the past, that dilapidated campground where so many things had gone wrong and right. This last stretch was the most beautiful part of the drive. The trees bent over the road like footmen, acquiescing to the early heat. The glossy leaves were dense and blocked out the sky. I could hear the scream of cicadas, but I found it comforting. I felt renewed as I drove this lane to paradise, to a completed novel. I had spent my life imagining a time when, instead of relying on the generosity of others, I would be able to stand on my own as an artist, refer to my published novel, released to modest but positive reviews. I was not so arrogant as to assume it would light up the world. Teach where I wanted to. Give small but respectable lectures for small but respectable sums of money. All of this now seemed within reach. A creature darted beneath my car. I swerved and braked so hard I could feel the car grinding in protest and the thunk of metal on body. Had it been icy or raining, I would have surely died, swung into the nearest tree. As it was, I came to an abrupt halt in the middle of the lane. I looked in my rearview mirror, terrified to see what lay in the road. There was nothing. I got out of the car and looked beneath the chassis. There, the black, lifeless eyes of a rabbit met mine. The lower half of her body was missing, as neatly as if she were a sheet of paper that had been ripped in two. I stood and walked around the car, looking for the other half. I even knelt down again and peered up into the labyrinth of the car's undercarriage. Nothing. I'm sorry, I said to her blank eyes. You deserved better than that. Better than me. I sat down heavily in the driver's seat, twin spots of dirt on my jeans for my trouble. Distress came over me like a wave of nausea. I hoped this was not some sort of omen. Ahead of me, there was a blue sign with an arrow pointing right. Devil's Throat, it said. No pleasantries here. As my car wound around the edge of the property, I understood that I would only be seeing a small fraction of it during my stay. It was hundreds of acres, much of it undeveloped. Devil's Throat had once been a lakeside resort for New York millionaires. But the owners overextended their finances, and the entire endeavor collapsed during the Great Depression. The current owner was an organization that funded fellowships providing time and space to writers and artists to do their work. The residency, I discerned from the map that had arrived in the mail soon after my acceptance letter, occupied the southernmost corner of the resort, a cluster of studios and a main building that had once been the sumptuous hotel. The studios themselves rimmed the periphery of a lake, where the wealthiest of the residents had stayed for entire summers, lazing around in the muggy heat. I followed the road until the trees finally parted. The former hotel swelled out of the ground like an infection, a disturbance in the woods. It had clearly once been a grand structure, radical in design, the kind of work done by ambitious young architects not yet crushed by years of anonymity and unfinished blueprints. Two cars, one ancient and dirty blue, the other red and glinting in the sunlight, were parked haphazardly next to the hotel. I pulled in beside the red car, and then, nervous, pulled out again and parked next to the blue car instead. I suddenly felt self-conscious about the number of possessions in my trunk and back seat. I would have to unload, and it would take half a dozen trips. I got out of the car and left everything behind. The hotel's first story was ordinary but elegant, with dark gray stone and black mortar, slender windows that revealed choice cuts of interior, red velvet, wood-paneled walls, an abandoned coffee mug leaking steam on a side table. But the second story made the building more closely resemble a large piece of saltwater taffy, stretched and pulled to wild dimensions. The windows and their walls turned at odd angles from their first-floor cousins, tipping to and fro. You might, from one window, be able to see more of the ground than the sky, from another more of the sky than the ground. One of the rooms bent so close to the surrounding trees that a branch was arched toward the window. Surely a stiff breeze would instigate its advances. At the top, the roof sloped up and up until it came to a whorl of a point, like the tip of a dollop of cream. Resting there was a large glass orb. The steps leading to the front door were wide, so wide that if one stood in the middle, the banisters would be inaccessible. I walked up the right side, sliding my hand along the banister, until a splinter bit into my palm. I lifted my hand and examined the shard between my heart line and headline. I pinched the exposed wood and pulled. My hand contracted around the wound, which did not bleed. I mounted the last few steps to the porch. I hesitated before the opulent entrance, disliking how the wood curled in organic tendrils from where the doors met, like an octopus, emerging arm and suckers first from a hiding place. My wife had always teased me for my feelings and sensations, the things that I immediately loved or hated, for reasons that took months of thought to articulate. I dithered there, on the stoop, for a full 10 minutes before the door was opened by a handsome man in penny loafers. He looked startled to see me. "Hello," he said. He sounded like a drinker and possibly a homosexual. I took an immediate liking to him. "Are you coming in?" He stepped to the side and nearly vanished behind the door. "Yes," I said, stepping over the threshold. I told him my name. "Oh, yeah, I think..." He turned to the empty space behind him. "I think we thought you were going to come tomorrow. Perhaps there was a miscommunication." The doorway to the adjacent room ejaculated a flurry of activity, and I realized that he had been speaking to a trio of women just beyond my line of vision. A slender, pale waif in a shapeless frock, whose fractal pattern spiraled dozens of holes into her torso and created in me immediate anxiety. A tall woman, with dreadlocks coiled on top of her head and a generous smile. And a third woman whom I recognized, though I was also positive I'd never seen her before. The woman in the anxiety-provoking dress introduced herself as Lydia, a poet-composer. Her feet were bare and filthy, as if she were trying to prove to everyone she was an incorrigible bohemian. The tall woman said that she was a Neil and a photographer. The woman I did and did not recognize called herself by a name that I immediately forgot. I do not mean that I wasn't paying attention. Rather, she said her name, and as my mind closed around it, it slipped away like mercury from probing fingers. The man who had opened the door said, "She's a painter." He called himself Benjamin, and was, he said, a sculptor. "Why are you not at your studios?" I asked, regretting the imprudent question as soon as it left my mouth. "Midday boredom," said Anil.
"Mid-residency boredom," clarified Lydia. "The more social among us," she gestured to the people around her. "Sometimes eat lunch here in the main hall, to stop ourselves from going crazy."
"We just finished," said Benjamin. "I was heading back.
But I bet if you stick your head in the kitchen, you can catch Edna and she can fix you something to eat.
I'll take you there, said Anil. She hooked her arm in mine and walked me away from the others. As we crossed the foyer, I felt a fresh burst of fear regarding the woman whose name I could not seem to retain. The painter, I said, hoping that Anil would provide the relevant information.
Yes, she said. She is lovely.
She is lovely, Anil agreed. She pushed on a set of double doors.
Edna?
A wiry woman was hunched over the sink, where she appeared to have been gazing into its soapy depths. She straightened and looked at me. Her hair was flame red and was tied behind her head with a black velvet ribbon.
Oh, she said upon seeing me. You're here.
I am, I confirmed.
My name is Edna, she said. I'm the residency director.
She pulled off her yellow rubber gloves and proffered a hand, which I took. It was cool and damp, like a freshly wrung-out sponge.
You're early, she continued. A full day.
I must have read my letter incorrectly, I whispered. I flushed scarlet, and I could hear my wife's gentle laughter, my mortification on full display.
It's fine, she said. No harm done.
I'll take you to your room. Your bed might not have sheets. Back in the foyer, Benjamin was standing among all of my things. My suitcases, the hamper, even my car's emergency supply backpack, which was not supposed to leave my trunk.
Did I leave my car unlocked? I said.
Why would you lock it here? He asked cheerfully. Here you go.
He bent down and lifted my suitcases. I picked up the hamper. Edna bent toward the backpack, but I said, no need. And she straightened back up. We mounted the stairs. I woke up after the sun had set, as the last dregs of light were pulling away from the sky. I felt disoriented, like a child who has fallen asleep at a party and woken up clothed in a spare bedroom. I reached out instinctively for my wife, and met only high thread count sheets and a perfectly fluffed pillow. I sat up. The wallpaper was dark and dappled with hydrangeas. I could hear sounds coming from the first floor, murmuring chatter, the kiss of silverware and porcelain. My mouth tasted terrible, and my bladder was full. If I could sit up, I could use the toilet. If I used the toilet, I could then turn on the light. If I turned on the light, I could locate the mouthwash in my suitcase and get rid of this musty feel. If I could get rid of the musty feel, I could go downstairs and have supper with the others. As I swung one leg from the bed, I had a monstrous vision of a hand darting from beneath the bed's skirt, grasping my ankle and dragging me beneath, while the sound of delighted banter in the dining room drowned out my horrified screams. But it passed. I swung my other leg down, stood, and stumbled to the bathroom in the dark. As I voided my bladder, I considered my novel, such as it was, that is, piles of notes and papers wedged into a notebook. I thought about Lucille and her predicaments. They were so many. I came downstairs, the residue of mouthwash burning between my teeth. A long table of dark wood, cherry, perhaps, or chestnut, either way it was stained a rich crimson, was set for seven people. My fellow residents clustered in the corners of the room, chatting and holding glasses of wine. Benjamin called out my name and gestured to me with his glass. Anil looked up and smiled. Lydia remained deep in conversation with a slender, pretty man, whose fingers were smudged with something dark, ink, I imagined. He smiled shyly at me, but said nothing. Benjamin handed me a glass of red wine before I could tell him that I do not drink.
Thank you, I said instead of no thank you.
I heard my wife's warm voice, as if she were next to me, whispering into my ear.
Be a sport, I believed that my wife loved me as I was. But I had also become certain that she'd love a more relaxed version of me even better.
"Are you set up?" he asked. "Or were you resting?"
"Resting," I said, and took a sip of the wine. It soured against the spearmint, and I swallowed quickly. I suppose I was tired from the drive.
"That drive is horrible, no matter where you come from," Anil agreed.
The kitchen door swung open, and Edna emerged, carrying a platter of sliced ham. She set the plate down on the table, and on cue, everyone left their conversations and began to gather around their chairs.
"Are you settled?" she asked me.
I nodded. We all sat. The man with smudged fingers reached across the table and shook my hand limply.
"I'm Diego."
"How is everyone's work going?" asked Lydia. Every head dipped down, as if to avoid answering. I took a piece of ham, a scoop of potatoes.
"I'm heading out tomorrow morning," Edna said, "and I'll be back at the end of the week. Groceries are in the fridge, of course. Does anyone need anything from civilization?"
A smattering of no's rose from the table. I reached into my back pocket and produced a pre-stamped, pre-addressed, pre-written letter to be sent to my wife, confirming that I had arrived safely.
"Can you mail this for me?"
I asked. Edna nodded and took it to her handbag in the hall. Lydia chewed with her mouth open. She dug something out from between her molars, gristle, then ran her tongue over her teeth and took another sip of wine. Benjamin refilled my glass. I didn't remember finishing, but I had somehow. My teeth felt soft in my gums, as if they were lined with velvet. Everyone began talking in that loose, floppy way wine encourages. Diego was a professional illustrator of children's books, I learned, and was currently working on a graphic novel. He was from Spain, he said, though he had lived in South Africa and the United States for much of his adult life. He then flirted a little with Lydia, which lowered my estimation of them both. Anil told me a funny story about an awkward encounter with an award-winning novelist, whose name I did not recognize. Benjamin described his most recent sculpture, Icarus, with wings made of broken glass. Lydia said that she'd spent all day banging on the piano. "I didn't bother any of you, did I?" she said in a voice that suggested that she didn't give a whit one way or the other. She went on to explain that she was composing a poem song and was currently in the song part of the process. The walls were soundproof, Edna assured her. You could be murdered in there and no one would ever know. Lydia leaned toward me with an expression of deep satisfaction. "Do you know what the Richie Riches used to call this place before they lost it?"
"Angel's Mouth," I said.
"I was in scouting as a girl, and we came here every year. I always remember seeing the sign."
"Angel's Mouth!"
she half-shouted, as if I hadn't spoken. She slapped the table and laughed uproariously. Her teeth looked rotten, stained plum. I hated her, I realized with a start. I'd never hated anyone before. Certainly people had given me discomfort, made me wish I could blink and disappear. But hate felt new and acidic. It rankled. Also, I was drunk.
"What do they do at Girl Scout camp?" Benjamin asked. "Swim? Hike? Fuck each other?"
suggested Diego. Lydia slapped him playfully on the arm. I took a sip of wine, which I could no longer taste. We made crafts and earned badges. Cooked over the fire, told stories. That had been my favorite part. We usually were there in autumn, so it was too cold to swim, I said, but we did walk along the shoreline and play chicken on the pier sometimes.
"Is that why you're at this particular residency?" Anil asked. "Because you know the area?"
"No," I said. "Just a coincidence." I set my glass down and almost missed the table.
Then there was Lydia's hideous barking laugh. Diego's face was buried in her long hair, dropping some secret observation into her ear. She looked at me and laughed again. I blushed and busied myself with my meal. Anil finished her wine and placed a hand over the glass when Diego lifted the bottle. She turned to me. "While I'm here, I'm working on a project that I'm calling The Artists," she said. "Would you be willing to spend an afternoon doing a portrait session with me? No pressure, of course." The pressure felt real. But I was drowsy, and also I already liked Anil in the way that I liked some people. She seemed overwhelmingly well-intentioned, and was, it could not be denied, strikingly beautiful. I saw she was watching me expectantly, and I realized I was smiling for no apparent reason. I rubbed my numb face with my palms. "Happily," I said, biting the inside of my cheek. My mouth went to metal. By the next morning, a chill had descended upon the Pea Mountains, and the grounds outside the window of the kitchen were shrouded in mist. "Do you drink coffee?" Anil said behind me. I had barely nodded when she placed into my hand a warm and heavy mug, which I sipped from without examining it. "I can walk you down to the studios," she said. "I'd be happy to. It's hard to get there if you don't know the way, even when everything isn't obscured in fog." "Did you sleep well?" I nodded again. A small animal in my brain stirred with intent to vocalize and thank Anil for her many kindnesses. But I could not remove my eyes from the whiteness beyond the window, how easily it obliterated everything. When the front doors shut behind us, I jumped. From the steps, I could just see the outline of trees, which we had to pass through to reach the lakeside. Anil set off through them, finding the path. She hopped effortlessly over a fallen log and swerved around a patch of fat, glistening mushrooms. At some point, we passed a narrow white bench, whose design and dimensions suggested it was not meant for resting. Without turning, she gestured toward it. "The bench is about halfway between the lake and the hotel, just for reference." When the trees were behind us, I saw the faintest impressions of buildings. One loomed directly in front of me. For the first time, I broke from Anil's wake and stepped toward it, hoping for clarity with proximity. "Jesus!" Anil grabbed the strap of my bag and pulled me back. "Be careful! You almost just walked into the lake!" In front of me, the air was like milk. No building in sight. She gestured to her right, where a series of steps ascended toward shadow. "This is you. Morning Dove, right?" "Yes," I said forcefully. "Thank you for showing me the way." "Be careful," she said. "And if you need to get back..." She pointed to where we'd come from. A ball of light glinted even through the mist. "That's the hotel. That light is illuminated at night and during bad weather, so you can always find your way home. Happy riding!" Anil vanished into the mist, though I heard her feet displacing pebbles long after she had gone. My cabin was a generously sized building with an office that overlooked the rim of the lake, or would, when the fog abated. There was even a small deck, for work on the days without too much sun or rain, or for relaxation or observation. Despite its age, the building was reassuringly sturdy. I walked around, taking hold of various joints and railings, shaking them to see if anything was rotting or came off in my hand like a leprous limb. All seemed solid. Inside, a series of wooden boards sat on a shelf above my desk. At first glance, they resembled Moses's tablets, but when I stood on a chair and examined them, I saw that they were lists and lists of names, some clear, some illegible, of previous residents. The names and dates and jokes ran together like a Dadaist poem. Solomon Sayer, fiction writer. Undine LaForge, Painter, June 19. Ella Smythe, Summer of Love. C. I frowned. Someone with my name, another resident, had occupied this cabin many years ago. I ran my finger over my name, over her name, and then rubbed it on my jeans. A curious term, resident. It seemed at first glance incidental, like a stone. But then if you turned it over, it teemed with life. A resident lived somewhere. You were a resident of a town or a house. Here, you were a resident of this space, yes. Not really, of course, you were a visitor. But whereas a visitor suggests leaving at the end of the night and driving out in the darkness, resident means that you set up your electric kettle, and you will be staying for a while. But also, that you are a resident of your own thoughts. You had to find them, be aware of them. But once you located your thoughts, you never had to drive away. A letter on my desk welcomed me to Morning Dove Cabin, and encouraged me to add my name to the newest tablet. From my desk, I could see half of my porch, and then the opacity of the fog consumed the railing and all beyond it. I unpacked my bag, and then placed my notebook next to the computer, where it fairly hummed with portent. The novel. My novel. I began to work. I decided to outline my novel on index cards so that they would be easy to move around. The entire wall was made of corkboard, and so I thumbtacked the cards in a grid, pinning up Lucille's trials and triumphs in a way that could be easily manipulated. A centipede crawled along the wall, and I killed it with a card that said, "Lucille realizes her entire childhood has been a terrible lie, from the first sentence to the last." Its legs still twitched after I painted the plaster with its innards. I made a new card, and threw that one away. The one that said, "Lucille discovers her sexuality at the edge of an autumn lake," was pinned in the middle, which is where my plot abruptly stopped. My eyes scanned the cards. Baxter escapes and is struck by a car. Lucille's girlfriend breaks up with her because she is difficult at parties. Lucille enters the art festival. I felt pleased with my progress, though a little concerned that I wasn't entirely positive how I was going to maximize Lucille's suffering. Losing the art festival's grand prize wasn't enough, probably. I made a cup of tea and sat down, where I remained staring at the cards until dinner time. Just before dawn, I woke up with a soapy taste gathering around my molars. My body lurched from the bed. I fell to my knees before the toilet, still shoving away wisps of dreams as a hot burp signaled what was to come. I had been sick before, but never like this. I vomited so hard that I wrenched the toilet seat from its hinges with a terrible crack and rested my head on the cool tile until it seemed clean and the best of things. I sat up again, and still more, impossibly more, emerged from my body. To cool down, I crawled into the bathtub. When I looked up at the showerhead in the seconds before it belched icy relief, it was dark and ringed with calcified lime, like the parasitic mouth of a lamprey. I vomited again. When I was certain that nothing remained inside me, I crawled back to the bed, where I pulled the heavy duvet over my body and receded inside myself. My illness persisted for some time. My fever spiked, and the air around me shimmered like heat over blacktop. I thought to myself that I should get to a hospital, that my mind was, like the rest of my body, baking. But the thought was a twig, bobbing along through Noah's deluge. I was freezing, and buried myself in my blankets. I was roasting alive and stripped naked, the sweat crystallizing on my skin. At the very worst of it, I reached to the other side of the bed to feel for the contours of my own face. I believed that I cried out for my wife many times, though how loudly or if I did so at all is something I will never know. I believe it rained, because outside the window, something wet smacked the glass in waves. In the height of my fever, I believed that this was the sound of the tide, and I was sinking beneath the ocean's surface, dropping out of sight of heat and light and air. I was thirsty, but when I tried to sip water from my trembling palm, I vomited again, my muscles aching from the heaving. I am dying, I thought to myself, and that is that. I woke up in the thin strains of morning, with a person gently rapping on my door, calling my name. Anil. Are you all right? She asked through the wood. We're all really worried about you. You've missed dinner for two nights. I could not move. Come in, I said. The door swung open, and I heard Anil suck in a sharp breath. I appreciated later what caused this. The room was hot and sour. It smelled of fever and stale sweat, of vomit and weeping. I have, I said, been ill. She came over to the bed, which I thought was kind, considering the nuances of contagion. Do you... Should I call Edna? She said. If you could bring me a glass of water, I said, it would be much appreciated. It felt as if she had dissolved, but then she was back with a glass. I took a sip, but for the first time in days my stomach did not move except to growl with hunger. I downed the entire glass, and though it did not slake my thirst, I felt my humanity climb back into me. Another, please? I said, and she refilled the glass. I finished it and felt renewed. There's no need to call Edna, I said. If you're sure, she said, let me know if you need anything. Has any mail come for me? I asked. A letter from my wife would be comforting. No, nothing, she said. I began to write that afternoon. My legs felt shaky, and there was a strange rasping sensation in my chest. But I wrote in short bursts and felt mostly fine. The painter came by my cabin and knocked on my door. I started at the intrusion, but she said something and offered me a small box of medicine. I did not reach for it. What was it that my mind kept from me when forgetting her words? She said something else, and shook the box at me again. I took it. Then she reached up and touched my face. I flinched, but her fingers were cool and dry. She walked down the stairs and went to the lake's edge, where she reached down, picked up something from the grass, and flung it into the water. I pushed one of the pills through the blister pack's foil and examined it. It was oblong, with no numbers or letters, and it was a reddish-orange, except also a little purple and blue, and greenish if you turned it. And if I held it into the light, it went white as an aspirin. I tossed the box into the trash and the pills into the toilet. They drifted around the bowl like tadpoles, before zooming out of sight when I flushed. As I felt stronger, I began to take walks around the lake. It was bigger than it appeared, and even when I walked for an hour, I covered only a fraction of its perimeter. On the third day of these journeys, I walked for 2 hours and discovered a beach with a partially submerged canoe lounging in the tide. The gentle motion of the water caused the canoe to rock ever so slightly, and reminded me of the way the canopies of the trees had undulated in the wind during camp. Thumb, 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 thumb. The Girl Scout camp of my youth had been on a lake as well. Could it be on the other side of this same lake? If I hiked long and far enough, would I come upon that dock where my own predilections were solidified and mocked on that crisp autumn evening? Would I locate that romantic, terrible idol? The idea had not occurred to me before. I'd always assumed it was some other lake, up here in the mountains. But the rhythm of the water and the memory of the trees seemed to confirm that I had returned to a place from my past. It was then I remembered that I had once been sick at camp. How had I forgotten? This was the unspoken pleasure of the residency, the sudden permission of memory to come upon you. I remembered one of the leaders taking my temperature and clucking her tongue at the number. I remembered a sense of despair. Here on the beach, the despair felt clear, as if I'd been seeking its signal for decades and had just now come in range of a cell tower. I walked a little farther and noticed something red in the beach's stones. I knelt and picked up a small glass bead. It looked like it had come from a camper's bracelet. Perhaps it had been in the water for quite a long time and had washed up on this shore just for me. I put it in my pocket and walked back to my cabin. That evening, when I undressed for bed, I noticed a small raised bump on the inside of my thigh. I pressed it. A shock of pain bisected my leg, and when it passed, I observed that the bump was soft, as though filled with liquid or jelly. I felt my fingers twitch with the desire to squeeze it, but I resisted. The next day, however, there was another, and then another. They clustered on my thighs, erupted underneath my breasts. I was alarmed. Perhaps there was some kind of insect here that I hadn't known about, not ticks or mosquitoes, some kind of poisonous spider. But I thought about how I slept and in which kind of garment, and could not fathom how I'd been bitten. They did not itch, but they felt full, and I felt full, as if I needed release. I sat on the edge of the bathtub, burning a safety pin over a lighter. The metal blackened slightly, and I blew on the shaft and tested it for heat with the pad of my finger. Satisfied that it was cool and sterile, I inserted the pin into the original objection. It resisted only briefly, a split second of thrashing fits before yielding, and then discharged. A limb of pus and blood climbed the stock of the needle before collapsing under its own weight and trailing down my leg like an untended menstrual cycle. I soaked half a roll of toilet paper, cheap toilet paper, but still, with my own blood, taking out one after another. I felt pleasantly sore afterward, but cleansed. I covered each one with a blob of ointment and a slick bandage. Anil came to my cabin one early evening to collect her promised portrait session. She looked sweaty and triumphant, and straps of large camera bags crisscrossed her torso. I glanced behind her and saw dark clouds in the distance. A storm? It's a while off, she said, as if reading my mind. A few hours, at least. This won't take very long, I promise. We walked back toward the hotel, and then veered off into a meadow about a half mile away. The grasses became taller and taller, and eventually came up to our waists, and more than once I leaned over to assure myself that my pants were tucked into my socks to discourage tick bites. The third time I did this, I stood and noticed Anil had stopped and was watching me. She smiled, then kept walking. "Did you enjoy scouting?" she asked. "How long did you do it?" "From brownies until seniors. Almost my whole girlhood." The word brownies broke off into my mouth like something cloying, stale, and I spit it onto the ground. "You don't seem like a girl scout," she said. "What does that mean?" I asked. "You just seem very ethereal. I guess I think of Girl Scouts as hardy and outdoorsy." "It is possible to be both." I stopped and looked down at my legs. where the thumb of a band-aid poked out from beneath my shorts. Anil had not stopped walking, and I rushed to catch up. The grass ended suddenly, and we were at a large elm. In front of the trunk was a wrought-iron chair painted white.
"Oh, perfect timing," said Anil. "The light."
I was not a photographer. I had never professionalized my visual observations, only my theories and perspective problems and narrative impulses. But she didn't need to explain further. The sun was low, and everything was awash in honey light, including my skin. Behind the tree, the impending storm darkened the sky. Were we driving toward the storm? A photograph of the side mirror would reveal light in the past and darkness in the future? Anil handed me a white sheet.
"Can you wear this?" she asked.
"Only this. Just wrap it around your body, however you feel comfortable." She turned around and began setting up her camera.
"Tell me about the brownies," she said.
"Oh," I said, "brownies were little girls, kindergarten age." The name came from these little house elves who supposedly lived in people's homes and did work in exchange for gifts. There's this whole story about a naughty brother and sister who always wanted to play and never wanted to help their father clean the house. I unbuttoned my blouse and unhooked my bra. Then the grandmother tells them to consult this old owl nearby about these little imps. And while she technically tells both of the children, the little girl goes to find the owl. I wrapped the sheet tightly around my chest, like a modest lover in a television show aired before late night.
"I'm ready," I said.
Anil turned. She came over and began to fiddle with my hair.
"Does she find the owl?"
I tried to frown slightly, but Anil was brushing some lipstick over my mouth, blunt as a thumb.
"Yes," I said, "she does. It gives her a riddle, to find the brownie."
"God damn it," she muttered. She pushed around the outline of my mouth, her fingers slipping against the cosmetic wax.
"Sorry, I overshot the edge of your lip."
She began to apply it again.
"What's the brownie riddle?"
The bottom went out beneath me, and for a very brief second, I was certain that the distant lightning had reached out and flicked me, like the finger of a god.
"I don't remember," I whispered.
Anil's eyes left my mouth, and she looked at me for a long, hard second before twirling the tube shut.
"You're very beautiful," she said, though whether her voice was admiring or merely reassuring was difficult to tell.
She pushed me down into the chair and returned to her camera. My skin was glazed with heat, and a mosquito screamed past my ear and bit me before I could flick it away. For the first time I noticed the camera, which she must have set up while I was changing. It looked like an old-fashioned thing. It seemed that Anil would lean over and cover her head with a heavy cloth and take the photo by depressing a button at the end of a cord. I did not know such cameras still existed. She saw me looking.
"It's called a large-format camera. The negative is about the size of your hand."
She tilted my chin upward.
"Now," she said, "what I need you to do is to fall over."
"Pardon?" I asked. I felt a ripple of thunder through the bones of the chair. This detail had not been in her original request, I was certain.
"I need you to fall out of the chair," she said. "However you land, stay that way. Keep your eyes open and your body still."
"The faster we do this, the less likely we are to get rained on," she said, her voice firm and friendly. She smiled widely and then disappeared beneath the camera's hood. I hesitated. I looked down at the earth. The grasses were glowing with the light from the sunset, but I could see dirt and rocks. I did not want to injure myself. Truth be told, I didn't even want to dirty myself. Anil came out from under the hood.
"Is everything okay?" she asked.
I looked at her face, and then back at the earth. I tipped over. The surprises came all at once. First, the earth was not as hard as I had imagined it. It yielded, as if it were loam. The sun, which had been hidden behind Anil's body, was now uncovered and glowed between her legs like some mythical entreaty. I heard the dry click of the shutter, the sound of some insect biting down. There was lightning then, distinct, forking across the sky and over the distant hotel. So many omens. I felt strangely content there, on the ground, as if I could stay there for hours, listening to the cicadas and watching the light change and then vanish. And then Anil was kneeling down in front of me, helping me sit back up. "We have to run. We have to run," she said. And if I felt any anger or strangeness, it was crushed beneath this girlish appeal. She tossed my clothes to me and folded down the camera. At that moment, the last of the day's heat vanished, as if sucked down a drain, replaced with the chill of oncoming rain. Anil began to run, and I followed her, my clothes clutched to my bosom, the sheet flapping behind me. I felt light, airy. I laughed. I did not turn around to look at the sky, but I could visualize it as clearly as if I had. Clouds roiling upon us like men at a bar, suffocating, and us laughing together away. I heard the rain, then, the sound of something tearing, and we were up on the porch in seconds. When I turned back, the distant trees and sky, and even our cars were visually obliterated by the downfall. I was soaked through. The sheet was filthy now, dirty and half-translucent, and clinging to me like a condom. I felt elated, happier than I'd been in months, perhaps even years. Was this friendship? Was this how things were supposed to be? It felt that way, that I had ecstatically stumbled into happiness, and everything seemed right and correct. Anil looked beautiful, barely winded. She smiled at me. "Thank you for your help," she said, and disappeared into the hotel. I made progress on my novel. I found that the index cards hindered my process, so I simply buckled down over my keyboard and wrote until I emerged from my trance. Sometimes I sat on the porch and gave imaginary interviews to NPR personalities. "When I write, I feel like I'm being hypnotized," I told Terry Gross. It was at that moment I knew everything was going to change, I told Ira Glass. "Pickled things and shrimp," I told Lynn Rosetto Casper. I crossed paths with the others at breakfast sometimes. One morning Diego told me about the previous day's social engagements, which I had ignored in favor of Lucille's social engagements near my novel's climax. And in doing so he said a curious word. "Colonist." "Colonist?" I said.
"We're at an artist colony," he said. "So we're colonists, right? Like Columbus."
He drained his orange juice and stood up from the table. I suppose he meant it to be funny, but I was horrified. Resident had seemed such a rich and appropriate term, an umbrella I would have been content to carry all of my days. But now the word colonist settled down next to me with teeth. What were we colonizing? Each other's space, the wilderness, our own minds? This last thought was a troubling one, even though it was not very different from my conception of being allowed to be a resident in your own mind. Resident suggests a door hatch in front of your brain, propped open to allow for introspection, and when you enter, you are faced with objects that you'd previously forgotten about. "I remember this," you might say, holding up a small wooden frog, or a floppy rag doll with no face, or a picture book whose sensory impressions flood back to you as you turn the pages. A toadstool with a wedge missing from its cap, a flurry of luminous autumn leaves, a summer breeze dancing with milkweed. In contrast, colonist sounds monstrous, as if you have kicked down the door hatch.